All right, looks like we have ignition.
And welcome to the May Mike and Scotty Live Show. I'm Scotty, and that's Mike.
Hello there.
We just had this ridiculous false start, folks, that was probably funnier than anything we've done in a long, long time. But you're never going to hear it, so off we go. And
You
Mike,
heard something like it on the first show. I saw no need to repeat that.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I don't mean to drag these things out. Hey, we've had a busy month, you especially, and I can't wait to talk about all of the things that you've done this month. Mainly, your first op session on the new version of your layout, and it was kind of a test bed for how the layout operates, all the changes you've made, as well as some other kind of theoretical ideas that you've run through your head, and we're going to jump into that, Mike. How'd it go?
It went smashingly well, like beyond my wildest dreams well. And how often does that happen? So I was very pleased about that, and I think everybody was probably pleased about it too, because obviously when you are going to something like that, you don't want to be part of some kind of ongoing disaster, and they're all friends of mine. They know how much has gone into this, and I think people want you to succeed, but it's all theoretical until that first time you do it, and I still have memories of my very first op session way back when, which wasn't a total disaster, but it wasn't exactly a smashing success either.
Well,
At that time, I didn't know what I didn't know, and the lessons that came out of that op session, took me a long time to sort of get everything right that came out of that. For this one, I already had all of that knowledge. I already knew what problems I was trying to solve, and all we had to do really was to see if I got them all, and if the theory of the operations was sound or not,
so that original op session way back when,
You might even have been there for that. I think that
I was there.
yeah.
That evolved into a series of operating sessions that allowed you to tweak that version of that layout to the point where it couldn't be tweaked anymore. But, and correct me if I'm wrong, it gave you a fairly strong sense of what you needed to do in order to really make that layout operate the way you wanted it to, which has led to all of the renovations that you've made to the layout, which led to last Saturday. So
Yeah,
I'm not surprised that last Saturday went as good.
I think that closely sums it up. I guess the other part of that would be that, in addition to everything that you said, there's also been a lot of new information that has come in terms of my prototype and my realization of what I would like to be modeling that I just didn't know at that time. So when you combine that with all of the lessons learned in all of those op sessions, plus the influential, significant, odd comment that one or two people made that made me go, when you combine all of that together, that was sort of the impetus for all of the wholesale changes. So for this op session, I just invited basically four people to come, because I knew I wasn't going to be running a full complement of mainline trains. I mean, usually we're running two or three mainline trains each direction. And this time I only had one in each direction plus an extra that was going to go to Mehoopany for the first time. So that was also an experiment. We had a lot more locals. We had probably twice the number of locals, none of which had ever been run. And I didn't know how long these jobs were going to take. In fact, there was one local where I looked at it and I thought, phew, boy, this looks like a 3-hour job, basically, with the number of things this guy's got to do. And I wanted to see how my most experienced operators would handle this, and these were the people, I guess, that had been operating with me for the longest, and I really needed their input. I wanted to know what they thought of it. Was it fun? Could it have been done a little bit differently? Was the blocking right? How about the scheduling? Everything was completely theoretical. And I was realizing that as I was setting up for this op session, because prior to my hiatus here, I had kind of gotten the setup for the op sessions down pretty well. And as I was doing this one, I realized that in many ways I was starting from scratch again with that because everything was so different. Where I staged it was different in the basement. How I accessed that was different. Wasn't a double-ended staging yard anymore. So that my theories of how I would literally get the cars out of the boxes and put them on the trains, all of that needed to be proven. Was that going to be a huge pain? Was it just fine? Right across the board, everything about it was a learning curve. To my surprise, maybe learning something in all of this. It just kind of went pretty much as designed. Again, until that happens, it's all theoretical.
You had, anybody who's listened to this podcast knows that you are a very thoughtful, very analytical, very project management oriented person who's not going to shoot first and ask questions later. So I think to hear this and having heard you describe previous operating sessions and the changes that you made and the reasons why you made them, no one's surprised to hear that it went well. But to me, so now I've got a bunch of questions.
It's a lot of
But
variables. That's what
sure there is.
gave me the heebie-jeebies, When you change that many things, how can you really get them all right,
Sure. So what you did Saturday was tantamount to launching Apollo 7.
I guess.
This is, you fired the Saturn rocket. You collected your data. Everything came back like you thought it would. So what, where do you go from here? What's the evolution of this operating session, to the next operating session?
Well, we identified some of the things that would be helpful for running a more ambitious op session, for example. So I knew that I was going to need new paperwork because Pittston Yard didn't exist when I ran the last op session. And so I put Joe Posick on Pittston Yard because he's a very experienced yard guy, and that's really what he enjoys the most. And he also loves running Mehoopany, but I put Jim Reddington on that because that's typically what he ends up doing. So I was interested in his feedback on how different it was now with trains coming into a proper East Yard and how you interact with those trains and how it was how it altered his operation of Mehoopany. And it was the same thing with Pittston. Joe had all kinds of things to do there. We're running locals out of there. There's trains coming in with blocks of cars that needed to be broken up and disseminated. And by the same token, he had to get cars out of there and keep it fluid. So I was very interested to know what tools he lacked that would have helped him be able to do that. And one of the things we did was ended up creating a form that's a little bit like what we did for Mehoopany. Because I guess when you come right down to it, Mehoopany is a yard, sort of an operation too. There's actually 3 yards at Mehoopany, and so you kind of have to run it more like a terminal than an industry, if you can picture that. So we had worked hard to come up with a document that allowed the operator to sort of keep track of all these comings and goings and the status of these different cars, without having to write a book, without holding a stack of cards like 2 decks of playing cards, you know what I mean? Nobody really wanted to do that. But by the same token, you've got to have a way of keeping track of that information basically quickly and without too much fuss. So the paperwork that I've done has a lot of check boxes and things like that, and basically all you're writing on it are reporting marks. So
I see.
it makes it fairly straightforward to be making these changes, which once you get going, are now made in real time because the situation is fluid, it's ongoing.
Now, the as you've termed it, layout kaboom
Right.
was initiated. The plunger was pushed in order to create more fidelity to the prototype.
Sort of, but maybe I can just speak quickly as to what the goals of it were. So, really, the impetus for it was to get a full-fledged yard on the layout, which I didn't have. So it was Mike Confalone saying, "Gee, the layout's running great and looking good, and everything's humming along. The only thing it really it lacks is a major yard." And I just thought, yeah. And then I thought, how could I get that? And I thought about that for and thought about it, and had it all figured out, I thought. I mean, the idea of dropping the staging yard and creating Pittston Yard in that footprint was, I think, pretty sound. And I was going to basically do a helix, and you'd come out of staging and go up to that level and either go into the yard or go onto the layout. I had it all figured out. And then my buddy Dave said, "Gee, too bad the trains can't run through Pittston." And I looked at him and I just said, "You're kidding me, right? How the heck would I do that? They'd have to be coming from the left, and I can't put a helix over there, and I'm not going to destroy my entire layout just to do that." I said, "That's a non-starter. That's not happening." And
Right.
he just shrugged, and naturally I kept thinking about it and thinking about it, and I didn't pull the trigger on anything because I could understand the desirability of that. I just figured there's got to be a way to do it, And ultimately, it took me, I think, a good 6 weeks of kind of chewing on it mentally. I think I was out on my walk one day, and all of a sudden I kind of flashed on how I might do it. And couldn't wait really to get back and look at the layout and look at the track plan and see if my idea was feasible. But in a nutshell, what I ended up doing was using two walls of the basement as the helix. And all it required was me building a couple of hidden tracks underneath Ransom and Tunkhannock, which are the two towns on the extreme left as you walk in. So once I had figured that out, I thought, okay, now I've got something that's, as they say, actionable, right? And that's when the decision was made to do the kaboom, and then the decision to daylight that area over by East Yard and create East Yard. That was kind of an opportunity thing, as I was starting to make my determinations of what had to come out and where I was going to build it and all of that. I realized there'd never be a better time than right then to address that, and that this was a real opportunity to not to get rid of like one of the last things that bugged me on the layout. So that was like an additional portion of the project. And of course, now that you're moving things around and you're creating some new layout, you realize, well, geez, I need lighting in areas where I didn't have good lighting. So, to make a long story short, I ended up replacing all of my fluorescents with LED conversions, and then just required me rewiring each fluorescent fixture and taking out the ballast. The first one was a little bit tricky, and then once I figured out how to do it, I could do it in under 10 minutes per fixture. That also achieved a nice side benefit, and that is lower electric bills because the LEDs use so much less electricity. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think the electric company is talking to me anymore.
Well, it's better lighting. It's more lighting because I put in some more lights and much lower consumption. So it was, all good.
So, nothing's really inadvertent with you. There aren't a whole lot of coincidences, but maybe we'll chalk this up as a mild coincidence that as a result of these changes, it expanded the prototypical option. Operation options that you had. And
Yeah,
it
I
kind
think it made for a much more interesting op session because, we had, if you think about it, before this, you had Mahoopany as your primary focus. You had your road trains coming through who's basically, their reason for being was in large part to service this huge customer, And beyond that, yeah, there was some local business in the little towns and all of that, but it probably would have dried up without the Mahoopany business. And with the change of having this major yard now, and now we're running locals out of Sayre, we're running locals out of Pittston, so it's just greatly enhanced the possibilities for doing different things in your session. So I mean, I'm really looking forward to it being delightfully different each time. There's enough options that it's never going to be, the same old, same old, even though you'll be doing many of the same things each time, which is very railroady. It's kind of how railroading is.
I can't speak for every prototype modeler, but I know you, and as a prototype modeler myself, I know how I kind of attack things. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think that you spend at least as much time thinking about how the real trains ran on that railroad and adapting it to the model. And not just taking pictures of the prototype and throwing the track down and kind of figuring it out after the fact.
Yeah, no, I think that for me is part and parcel of prototype modeling, right? So if you're modeling an actual prototype, then the opportunity is there to learn what they were doing at that time on your layout. I think the best example of that was when I got to ride on my layout, so to speak, when I took that when I spent that very pleasant day on the Reading and Northern, switching Mahoopany and the paper mill at Ransom. That was so transformative for me because, that view from the cab, there's nothing else like that, really.
No,
And
there really
the
isn't.
opportunity to be a fly on the wall while the crews discussed how they were going to go about what it was that they had to do, I was struck by how similar it was to the discussions that we have here, because they had the same issues. They had the same problems to solve. So I was very encouraged by that because it made me feel like we were doing a pretty good job of replicating the way the prototype does it. If we have the same problems and things to be decided that they do, that tells me we're kind of getting it right. The other thing that I've had the opportunity of doing is speaking with people who operated on that line, people like Mike Bednar, and I've discovered some online video sources that show me operations on the Lehigh line during my modeling period, and I'm very visual, so seeing that, like that, really kind of cements it in my mind. It's the same reason I try to do an annual pilgrimage down there, and why riding on the train that day was so important. If I can see it, it helps me picture it in my mind, and then it helps me to be able to build it. And I think we talked about that before. If I can't see it in my mind, I can't even start to build it. That I've got to have some kind of reference in my mind that tells me what to do.
Yeah, I've operated on quite a few model railroads in my life. And without fail, the better operating layouts are the ones, and that there is an exception, which I know you're aware of. The better operating layouts are the ones that are strictly prototype based. And I think they've got a huge advantage in that they're basically just taking what the real railroad did. Which is only prototype centric. Their only concern is how to operate in an efficient manner.
Yeah, they don't do anything for no reason.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no track on there that they don't need.
Exactly. And if there is, it's covered in weeds or it's gone.
Yeah, it's about to be gone, right?
But and the exception is the Hoosic Valley lines, which people would swear is a real railroad anyway. I've operated on some freelance railroads where,
Well, Mike Confalones is another example of that.
and my conf well, again, people would swear that that's a real railroad too.
I think it's arguably in some ways that much more difficult to do it well because, yes, he's basing everything on prototype practices, which is why
But you've got no reference in terms of.
no exact reference, no specific reference. So that's I think the extra. In other words, it would be easier, I think, to get it wrong than right, you know? So it's a testimony, I think, to the folks who have done it right, to how well they've done that, how much talent is involved.
The interesting thing, the common thread with you and Mike Confalone and Dick Elwell, is that you're highly analytical people, and the three of you have built great railroads that operate exquisitely because of the thought process and the ability to translate either what the prototype did or prototype practices.
I guess you have to have a certain amount of that because you'd have to be awfully lucky to have that happen accidentally.
There can be some real comedy involved when those practices aren't put in place. I've operated on layouts where, the switch list says, put two cars on this siding, and the siding holds one car.
Right.
You spend 3 of the 4 hours operating by, picking up the locomotive and, moving it from one end of the train to the other because there's no runaround track anyway.
Right. Well, having too many cars for a spot is actually a prototypical problem, and very often that happens. And basically, the crew has to find a place to stick the car, and then it becomes a respot later. So some of those problems aren't as unprototypical as you might think, and in some cases, you don't want to make it overly simple. So you're kind of treading that fine line between an interesting switching puzzle that requires some thought and planning to an impossible brain bruiser that you're going to have a headache from when you're done, and I've been there too. I've operated on layouts where I've actually enjoyed that once, but it's not what you'd want to be doing all the time, and I endeavor above all else to make it a pleasant railroad to operate on.
There's
You
a
want people to look forward to coming in and doing that, ideally.
There is a layout and a model railroader, both of whom will remain nameless, for the sake of the innocent. And he's a nice enough guy, and he's a very, very talented modeler. But operating on that layout is sheer pain.
Really?
There is nothing fun about it. There are too many operators, too many trains, too many times where you've got to stop your train and wait, too many long pauses, not enough places to pull over. And everybody runs it differently, right? I mean, we've been to some operating sessions where it's very regimented, and took a little adjustment, but we had fun.
Sure.
There's just places that you go where it's just like, yeah, we're looking at your watch.
Well, the first time that you operate on any layout, you're basically not qualified to do it. And that's really what the prototype does when they have somebody working a new job in the railroad. They literally have to qualify on that territory, which means they ride on it with an experienced crew, and they have to get used to the territory and learn it. And I really think it's no different on a layout. You need to learn your way around there. You need to understand what the landscape is.
Well, I hearken back to our trip to our good friend Bill Darnaby's wonderful mommy layout. And
Yeah, I know. I was
we weren't
lost there. I don't know
qualified.
about you.
We weren't qualified. You hit the nail on the head, but we had people looking at us like, "What the hell are you doing?"
Right.
And I mean, we're both, pretty veteran operators, but
But you know,
boy.
I was much less so at that time. I think at that time, there's that expression again. I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't even know what questions to ask, really. You know what I mean? So, I think were I to be in a circumstance now where I was visiting a large, complicated layout for the first time, I think I would know what questions to ask. You know what I mean? And I might observe and just kind of get the hang of things initially. Plus, that was timetable operation, which I'd never done and knew nothing about. So that was like a whole other thing to learn. I still don't have like a good feel for that because it's not what we do.
Well, the whole thing was different, right? And on top of that, we wanted to make a good impression. We've got a guy, we're at
We
someone's
failed.
house who's, a world famous model railroader, surrounded by world famous model railroaders who are all operation centered.
Right.
And there's Andy Sparandio, whom I've looked up to for many, many years. And God bless him, the late Andy Sparandio. Actually snipped at me a couple of times because I wasn't in the right place at the right time using the right protocol.
And Andy was a great guy, but he was a serious model railroader, you know, and that I guess that's one of the things that impressed me also, that it was possible to be serious about it without being overly serious, and that and then if you tried that, it could actually enhance your fun with it, because you can only just poke around for so long, but if you're trying to do it right, if you're trying to do it well, it kind of gives you something that you can aim towards and enjoy improving upon over time, which is a whole other thing that I didn't really fully understand at that time when I didn't know anything.
So, here was a highly intelligent guy, who was, semi-serious. I remember having, some wonderful conversations at breakfast at Cocoa Beach with him
Right.
over the years and getting to know him a little bit. But this is a guy that flipped a switch when it came to operation.
Right.
And, different, very serious Andy came out. And it kind of reminded me, as you were using that analogy, it kind of reminded me of me when I'm standing on a pitcher's mound.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's a whole side of you I guess I haven't seen.
You don't want to dig in if you're the batter.
That's your
So,
plate that you're defending.
but we learned, I own that whole area. We learned so much from that operating session, Mike.
Right. And I think that's the takeaway, that I came away from that thinking, well, I'll bet I didn't impress anybody there.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. Dude, I'm sure I left and they were like, "Billy, you're not going to invite him back, are you?"
And I left thinking, I'd like to do better than that, next time.
Yeah, well, it certainly kind of gave you a sense of your skill level.
Well, it also gave me a sense of how interesting and complicated that it could be, right? It kind of opened my eyes a little bit. And the other thing that has changed things a lot for all of us here is having a real life professional dispatcher who knows what he's doing. It just it changed everything about our op sessions. Instead of just meandering around, there's a plan, there's a purpose, there's a reason for saying things in a certain way and doing things a certain way, and some good-natured ribbing when you don't or you forget something, you don't want to be the guy that forgets to line the main line switch. You know what I mean? You just you don't want to be that guy. You want to be a little more on top of things than that, which doesn't mean that you can't have fun. You just want to do it well.
So moving forward for you, but so we can wrap up this topic and move on, is the goal now? I know you've still got some construction issues to deal with. Are those kind of secondary to Now that you've got a sense of this operating session and what needs to be done, kind of focusing on the next operating session and how to make it even better.
Well, and this will shock you, I'm sure. I do have like a plan of action here. But it's so I'm going to dance around a little bit as I answer that question because there's a lot of aspects to it. So what I wanted to do was A, see how this one went, and it went just fine, so that B, I could plan a more normal, if you will, op session, not a test op session. And I suppose the question that somebody listening to that might have would be, well, what does that entail? How would it be different from what you just did? So for me, it would be run a few more trains. In other words, run the full complement of trains that you'd like to run. It would be to maybe have another person or two, because if you're running more trains, you've got to have the crews. Otherwise, you can't run the trains. There's nobody to run them. We had a couple of early departures the other day, and basically, Dave and I finished running the schedule on train night, Monday night, because we didn't get quite everything done. And that happens at Confalones too. He's got a big layout and an ambitious operating plan, so it's not unusual that you don't get all the work done. And what happens? It's just like the real life, just spills over into the next day or the next shift or whatever. So if you're going to run more trains, you need more people. Now, how many people do you need? One of the questions that we've wrestled with is, what's the right number of people for an op session? And it probably has less to do with the size of the basement, although it helps, because the bigger the basement, in theory, the more humans it can accommodate, or so you'd think. That hasn't really been the way it's played out, because what we find is if you have too many people reporting all at once, there's only so many simultaneous activities that can be going on the layout, no matter how big it is, right?
Just like the railroad.
Yeah, so you either address that with two-man crews, which in some cases are indicated, but in other cases it's just overkill. Or you do it, or you end up with a bunch of people sort of hanging around and rubbernecking and clogging up the aisles and kind of interfering with the general flow of things. So what we have discovered over time is you're actually better off with too few than too many people at an op session. Because you can always run the trains, but if you bog down an op session with too many people, basically nobody gets to have as much fun as they would if they were too few. That makes sense. It clogs up your aisles. It just kind of breaks the flow of everything. So what I found even at this op session was at one point we had gotten everybody out on the road, and it was just Dave and I standing there watching it, basically. We had four guys out on the layout doing stuff. And that's kind of, for me, that's the layout owner and creator, that's the hold your breath moment, because that's if the problems aren't going to start occurring until you get everything going on out there, but with the track properly tweaked, with the whole brand new electrical bus, with a more efficient track plan and scheme, I was hoping it would go like I wanted it to. So at that point, we just kind of took about 10, 15 minutes and watched it. We watched this whole thing just kind of lurch into gear and start functioning as a system, which is what it is, right? It's got to function as a system. And it was great to watch because people were doing their jobs. These are experienced operators, so they know what to do. You don't have to like hold their hand on everything. And it just flowed. So it was a good thing to watch. And I was thinking, if you had three more people standing here, that's just what they'd be doing. They wouldn't be in the flow, they wouldn't be in the moment. They'd either be jabbering to those people or jabbering to one another. They'd be in the way physically. They wouldn't be adding to the sort of everybody in the element aspect that we had achieved all of a sudden by doing that way. And Mike Confluent said the same thing. His basement is probably 50% larger than mine. So you would think that he could accommodate a lot more people at an op session. But the fact of the matter is, he has concluded that the ideal number of people for his op session is about the same number as for mine. Maybe the runs are a little bit longer, but you don't think of it in terms of run time. You think of it as job time. You know what I mean? And so really, we're looking at, if you don't count the layout owner, who really serves the function of train master. You know what I mean? Chief cook and bottle washer, problem solver, whatever, expediter. It's not unusual for the guy who owns the layout to, if he's lucky, run one train. And I'm fine with that, by the way, because for me, part of the fun of an op session is watching it come to life. Dave and I can run a train or two, like we did on Monday night, anytime. But to have the whole system in motion and functioning, it requires a group of people to do it. There's no other way to do it. So, other than the layout owner and the dispatcher, let's not count them as operators. The optimal number of operators is about four, believe it or not. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a couple more people there, but every person you add to that total, it's, progressively suboptimal. It's the only way I can describe it,
Well, it's the reciprocity effect, right? It takes longer to get anything done. The
Yep,
more people you have there, it's counterintuitive.
right.
The more people you have there, the longer it's going to take because the more people you've got, like you said, clogging the aisleways, but the more trains you've got backed up. That you're trying to jockey around so that other trains can get by. It just yeah, and it's funny for
It'd be different if you were at Ken McCrory's, you know what I mean? He needs 30 people to run his railroad. We'll never have that problem, you know what I
No,
mean?
and you've packed a lot of model railroad into a not huge basement.
Right. It's no more than an average size basement, really.
So if the end game is fun, then you need to make sure that it's staffed properly so that everyone's having a good time.
Sure. So, I mean, people ask all the time, and it's odd, they ask me all the time, like I've got some kind of special cachet. Boy, I sure would like to operate on Mike Confalone's layout. What do you have to do to get an invite up there? And my answer is always, well, it would help if he knew you. It would help, I'm not the pimp that arranges tours of visits to his layout. Run into him at an event, reach out to him via email or whatever. I mean, you're inviting people into your home. It's how you click with them. It's how they click with everybody else. And it's also, first come, first serve in a way. So, everybody that has a layout has their sort of core group that has been there from day one. And everybody else is kind of on the spare board. So slots don't open up unless one of your regulars can't make it, and I think people have a hard time really understanding that. And it's different if you have an open house. I mean, with an open house, you're not really trying to achieve anything. You might have a train running around, people are in and out, and that's a different scenario than running an op session. You know what I mean?
It's an opportunity to get, on one hand, it's an opportunity to get your friends together. On the other hand, you, in order to pull off the operating session successfully, you want to have a group of operators that are at least somewhat familiar with the layout and somewhat familiar with operating practices so that you're not spending your time, all you're doing is teaching them.
Right. Now that's different from a railroad company. For example, after the Enfield New England proto meet, I'll have a handful of people not local that'll be coming by to see the layout and to visit and maybe run a train or two. I'm not under any illusions about that being an obsession per se, but obviously we're going to run some trains so they get to, feel what it's like to operate on the layout. And almost by definition, that won't be the optimal number of people for an ideal obsession because it's not even really an obsession, That's a different circumstance.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that update. I mean, it's a sounds like it was an amazingly successful day. It also sounds like if you only need four people, that the next time I get an invite, it will probably be about 20 years down the road.
Well, don't hold your breath,
No, I'm not. I'm not.
but I think the takeaway is also that you don't always run an obsession with the same group of people. You might have an A team and a B team or whatever. You know what I mean? And people can be interchangeable. Some of my regulars are only sporadically available due to family issues and obligations and things like that. So there's always opportunities. Maybe not every single time, but there's often a slot that's available. But if it's more than like if optimal is four, of course you can include a fifth sometimes. And but every person you add after that, it just becomes less optimal. So, like in your case, probably you'd be more interested in an obsession that happens after baseball season.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now my next one, I'm going to try to do an actual obsession towards the end of July, and the reason there's that much of a gap is that I've got some crazy family stuff coming up. My son and his wife are coming up from Florida for a couple of weeks, actually, beginning of July, and my stepson and his wife and my grandson are venturing up for the first time later on in July.
Nice.
And I'm going down to my modeling area again in June, as I usually do. June's a good month to do it because you get those long days, and it's also if you're taking shots like for backgrounds and things like that, it's the right season. So I very often go down at that time. So that's in June, and by the time all, and plus there's another trip we're taking to New York to see the grandson before that. So next thing you know, it's the end of July. So that was the roundabout way of answering your question from way back of what I have planned to do on the layout before then. Just a few little things. I don't want to be making really any big messes. I think there's one structure, and it's associated, grounds and what have you, that is like this little undone spot in the midst of a whole bunch of other done layout. And I think I might just take a stab at seeing if I can get that together, get that presentable, as that word I keep using, before that obsession, so that something is different, and so that pictures that are taken down there don't have anything unfinished in the picture. And it'll also feel like, well, here's an area that doesn't really need much attention from me in the short term. Now I can kind of move beyond that. So that's, I think, the one thing that I'm going to try to accomplish before the end of July there. And I think it's doable. What I don't want to do is, having been so embroiled in trying to get everything ready for this session, I don't want to have another big deadline kind of a situation. And then I think once that July session is over, I'm probably going to try to schedule another session, maybe, I don't know, sometime in September, and then maybe one more, let's say early November. I'm just, kind of tossing things out of the top of my head. That'll give me four obsessions this year, and considering I didn't start until this weekend, and then I'm trying to do some things in between, that to me seems achievable and realistic.
Okay.
Of course, there's some other things in play too.
Okay. Well, you so was that the cue for me to move on to the next topic?
Doesn't take a house to fall on you, does it?
Oh, I am slick. So, as we were working on our agenda here, Mike said that he had a surprise announcement, but he wasn't going to tell me what it was because he wanted to get my reaction. So, drum roll, please.
And then Scott proceeded to tell me that good luck getting a reaction out of him. So,
So, Mike, I understand you have a surprise announcement.
well, I mean, it's not so much of a surprise, but it's not something that anybody listening to everything we've just spoken about would probably be able to predict. But
Okay.
I had talked about, the size of the layout, and I had talked about at some point, I'm sure I mentioned how, well, you are limited to the size of your basement, and I think I've creatively found every nook and cranny in my basement possible. So really, the only option at that point, if you want to do anything beyond that, would be to make more basement.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Now I know what you're thinking. How do you make more basement, Mike?
Well, you build an addition on the house.
That would be how you do it.
Wow. That's so Howard Zane of you.
Well, I want to go right out up front here and say, although this is not etched in stone,
Yep.
I am actively pursuing development of the plans and looking at the issues, which means that I've already started to spend some money on it.
Well, that's a great surprise. My head is spinning simply at the thought of what a whole new kind of construction process would mean to the existing layout. Having been there, done that, I know that it can be incredibly disruptive, and so I guess we file this under here we go again.
Yes and no. I mean, I think probably the right question to ask would be, is this a kaboom?
Well, I so you know what does this entail?
It's not a kaboom.
Okay.
The purpose of the kaboom, and by the way, anybody looking for my article on layout kaboom that I said was going to be in May in Model Railroad Hobbyist, an editorial decision was made to not have any columns any getting real column that month because he had too many columns. So it's coming out in the June issue, folks, and you can read about layout kaboom in detail in June, not the May issue.
Okay.
Sometimes these things happen. So
Okay.
the whole purpose of kaboom was to ch fundamentally change the layout and cure all of the things about it that bothered me that just weren't right. Okay, and to be honest with you, at this point, I really like my layout. I think I finally have the layout that I always wanted, and I feel like the areas of pain have been taken care of, and there should be no reason to tear up or significantly alter or destroy any areas that have been done during the kaboom and re-scenic. So this is, let's call it an end-to-end merger, as the railroads like to say, rather than a parallel kind of deal.
Okay.
But if you're thinking about this, you're probably thinking, why the hell would he do this at this point in time, at this point in his life? Why does he have some kind of problem that requires that he's always got some giant project that he's managing? I mean, I know I'm asking and answering all the questions in your mind here, but feel free to jump in.
Well, first of all, I would say, with regards to that Dick Elwell was 5 years older than you when he built a new house that doubled the size of his square footage.
There you
So,
go.
and it was, it certainly gave his wife Sandy what she wanted in terms of a new house. But don't kid yourself, and he'd be the first person to tell you it doubled the size of his layout room.
Right.
So, there's something to be said for the importance of keeping busy with something that we love. So I completely understand that. I guess the question, first question I have is that, how many square feet would this add?
The addition itself, I think, would probably be, I don't know, maybe 800 square feet or something like that. It's shaped like a bow tie, so it's a little hard to nail that down. That's something I'm hoping the architect will tell me, you know. But basically, that area, it's basically I'd fill in the area between my workshop and the existing basement with a one-story addition, if it happens. And I was thinking about it a lot this winter, you know. I mean, I'm going to be 61 this summer, so in some ways, you know, you look at that and you think, well, that's not that old, and that's how I'd like to look at it, but it's also not that young. And it just got me thinking about, you know, what do you want the next 20 years to look like? You know what I mean? What do you really want to do? What do you want to have happen? How do you want to run your life? How do you want to conduct things? And in the other question, I guess, that I was asking myself was, what would make it easiest for you to stay here indefinitely, right? Because that's my goal, you know. I like being here. Everything I like to do is here. It's not like I'm going to pick up and you know, move to Arizona or anything. This is where I want to be. So everything I do with snow removal and all of that kind of outdoor-y kind of thing, you know, anything that I can do right now might not necessarily be ideal if I'm 10 years older, right? So I started looking at it from that standpoint, and I looked at the areas that were the toughest to plow and required the most manual labor to shovel out, and I looked at, you know, running back and forth in the weather to my workshop, and I looked at the amount of increase in business in Dartmouth Locomotive Works with the install end of the business. It's just like an upward curve that shows no sign of stopping. So every time I modernize my install area, you know, 8 months go by, 10 months go by, and I've kind of outgrown it a little bit. So I started looking at all these different issues and the fact that, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have a little more layout area to, now that I have pitched and yard, to kind of incorporate the area, some area that is south of there, and maybe incorporate the D&H a little bit more. You know, there's lots of possibilities. And the more I looked at that, the more I thought, well, there's got to be some kind of grand unification theory here that solves all of these problems. And that's what I started looking at. And when I realized that it could involve an addition, that's when I kind of thought, well, we want to think this through. We really want to think this all the way through.
Yeah, you don't want to enter into that quickly.
I didn't even tell my wife for a couple of months of thinking about it because I wouldn't have known what to tell her. You know, I hadn't really thought it through sufficiently to be able to articulate what I was thinking of doing, you know, and then it started to gel about a month ago. And I even talked with one of my neighbors who used to be a contractor because I wanted to kind of do the whole how nuts am I litmus test of it on him, you know, and pick his brain about a couple of construction possibilities. And he said, you know, he said, you're really at the point where you need to talk to an architect. He said, you know, this is what they do. You know, they take your concept and they turn it into something you can visualize. I was playing with foam core and pieces of cardboard and trying to figure out how the roof would be, and he just kind of chuckled at that, and he said, yeah, you can do that till the cows come home, but it doesn't mean anything till an architect says, yeah, here's how you do it. So he recommended someone, and I've had some conversations with him already, and I think I've got the right guy. And in fact, he's coming over on Friday, weather permitting, which should be fine, with his drone. And the first thing he's going to do is take aerial pictures of everything,
Nice. That's
which
different.
never would have occurred to me, but it seems like an obvious great way to start. And I had explained the whole thing to him, and he seems to get it, and his fees are in line with what my expectation would be. So I think at the very least, I'm going to take it as far as I can without doing it. It's kind of the only way that you ultimately know what it's going to cost. So I'm committed to spending a little bit money on it, and if it comes in, you know, within some reasonable expected ballpark, I think it's gonna happen.
Well, don't discount the possibility that maybe You and I could just carve out a couple of weekends and get it done ourselves. I've got a full set of X-Acto tools, and I'm good with wood.
Well, part of it is that if you're going to do something like this, it's obviously beyond the scope of me doing it, So in terms of the impact to me personally, while of course it's going to be intrusive, it's not going to be one of these things that goes on for months and months and months and months and months. I'm trying to do this as a two walls and a roof kind of a project, because that's ultimately what it is. And in fact, the architect said the same thing. So, you point your, you agree on what needs to be done, you point your contractor at it, and you get it done. And meanwhile, you're doing some supervisory things and making some decisions and all of that. But my work doesn't even begin until the WeatherTight shell is up and the thing's inspected and all done. So, I think until you get to that point, it doesn't make that much of an impact on me. Then I think the next thing I would do would be to set up my new install area there and move my milling machine out of the woodworking shop right next to it, which would be efficient. And only then would I start be thinking about the layout. So really, it's probably a couple of years away at the inside of even driving in a screw on it.
Okay. All right. Well,
So we'll probably talk more about the planning of it.
probably, you think?
One of my goals on the trip down to my modeling area in June is to visit some new areas and see what floats my boat.
Sure. Well, it's podcast fodder. It's all good. Speaking of podcast fodder, Saturday. And the weather is supposed to be nice.
Finally.
Finally, yeah. You and I will be finally taking that field trip to the Grafton and Upton Railroad, and we have a tour lined up with one of the employees that that you've done some work for on model locomotives, a
Right.
gentleman by the name of Kevin. And Kevin has been gracious enough to set aside some time on his day off to take us around and show us the stuff.
Kevin's a super nice guy. Very knowledgeable and very entertaining. I think I guarantee a pleasant time on this. So the next time that we convene, we will have pictures that'll be posted on the group and lots to talk about in terms of our impressions.
Yep, looking forward to it. Anything else we need to address this this month, Mike?
Well, I think that was enough, don't you? We do these things, and to be honest with you, I never have any sense of how long it is. It's just an organic thing. It is what it is. Sometimes a little smaller, sometimes a little bigger.
Yeah, they ebb and flow, but I think we covered a lot of ground today, and you've certainly made important headway. With the layout, and when we convene again next month, like you said, we'll have a Grafton and Upton update for everyone. So,
Should be fun.
folks, thanks for listening.
See you then.